Today at Reader's Corner, Samantha Silva, the best-selling author of the new novel, Love and Fury. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. On today's program, novelist Samantha Silva rejoins us to talk about her latest novel, Love and Fury. Set in the late 18th century, the book centers on the life of Mary Wollstonecraft, one of the world's most influential thinkers and mother of the famous novelist Mary Shelley, who wrote Frankenstein. Samantha Silva's novel offers a fresh take on one of the pioneers of feminism, a woman reclaiming her own narrative to pass on to her daughter and all daughters for generations to come. Samantha Silva is an author and screenwriter based in Boise, Idaho. Over her career, she sold film projects to Paramount, Universal, and New Line Cinema. Her work has appeared in One Story and Lit Hub and has screened at the Sun Valley Film Festival. She last joined us in 2017 to talk about her celebrated debut novel, Mr. Dickens and His Carol. Love and Fury is her second novel. Samantha Silva, welcome back to Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much for having me, Bob. I'm happy to be back.
Well, here we are on Zoom, not in the studio as we did last time, but that's okay. We were just talking about the fact that publishers see some advantage to the fact that you and I are doing this online. And well, of course, you'd be here in Boise anyway, but instead of flying all over, running up bills for publishers, huh?
I think that as in so many parts of our life, the pandemic forced us to be resilient and redesign the way we work, the way we are at home, the way we are in the world. And some of that will have a lasting effect. And I think the publishing industry has probably figured out that virtual book launches and book tours are more cost effective for them. And also sort of make available to a much wider audience these events at bookstores around the country. So I think that may be here to stay. And once we are fully open again, post-pandemic, post-vaccination, I do think we'll have a hybrid that most publishers will probably follow a hybrid model and do virtual book tours and in-person events. So It's a lot to look forward to. But I think it's been a creative response to the pandemic that probably will have some lasting power.
Well, this one's going to work just fine for us. And I guess we should start at the beginning. For those of us who missed her in our survey of Victorian literature course, or wherever you might find her, please tell us who Mary Wollstonecraft was and why, even in the aftermath of her life, she was forgotten until later in the next century.
Mary Wollstonecraft is really one of the most important intellectuals, thinkers, philosophers, and writers of the late 18th century. And she is one of the very first people to really argue for gender equality and for the rights of women. So when the French Revolution happened, the conservative Edmund Burke wrote his famous treatise sort of defending monarchy and defending, you know, the rights of kings and the rights of churches to tell people who they were and where their fealty should lie. And everyone got busy sort of responding to Edmund Burke, but Mary Wollstonecraft was one of the people who did, and she wrote in very short order one of her first philosophical books called Vindication of the Rights of Men, which was meant to include men and women. But when she finished it, she decided, no, I really haven't gone far enough, and what I need to do is write Vindication of the Rights of Woman, which she did in about 6 weeks. And it's really completely an argument for women being equal to men and being educated the same as men, and that only in that lies the full potential of the human race, of the human species, and that God would never have created two creatures that were different from each other, and that in brain and soul, in mind and soul, men and women were alike, and they needed to be treated as such, educated as such, raised as such. And, you know, again, only then would we have sort of the full flowering of the human species. So she's very, very important. And she was famous in her time. I mean, these her vindications, both of them caused quite a stir. And she wrote reviews and novels and, you know, kind of her own memoir, letters when she's in residence, traveling around Scandinavia, which was a kind of mind-bending and genre-breaking book. But so she's really selling books and living as few women could at that time, you know, as a woman publishing under her own name and making her own living. But what happens, she dies, sadly, 10 days after she gives birth to the daughter who will grow up to be Mary Shelley. And her husband at the time, William Godwin, who was a radical philosopher, very important in England, decided he needed to rush to write her memoirs so that people could really understand the whole Mary Wollstonecraft and have the whole Mary Wollstonecraft experience. But what he did was include everything, including her sort of disastrous love affairs with Henry Fuseli, the artist Henry Fuseli, and the American sort of frontiersman and speculator Gilbert Imlay. And she had a child out of wedlock, and that's what people focused on, that she, you know, she suddenly became, instead of this important thinker and philosopher and writer, she became a whore. And it was a scandal, and people turned away from her, and they turned away from her daughter who'd been born out of wedlock prior to Mary Shelley. And it really sort of buried her reputation for almost a century until Virginia Woolf brings her back to life and says, you know, this woman is one of our most important thinkers and writers. And we feel her experiments in living today. She walks and breathes and talks among us, and her voice is important. And that revived her reputation very much so. And then in the 1970s, in the first, you know, sort of feminist movement, she became important as well.
I noticed that in 2017, there was actually a movie about her daughter, Mary Shelley. I think that might have been the name of it.
Well, in 2018 was the 200th anniversary of the publication of Frankenstein.
Oh, that was it then.
Yes, yes. So Mary Shelley was everywhere, sort of in the zeitgeist. And it's one of the things that led me to Mary Wollstonecraft, to the mother, because I was having a conversation with my agent, and we were talking about this, you know, the Frankenstein, Mary Shelley being just everywhere, being omnipresent. And my agent, Emma Perry, said, God, but so few people know about her mother, Mary Wollstonecraft, who was really every bit as important, and many consider the mother of Western feminism. So I started reading about her and just became completely compelled and captivated by her life and her, tragically cut short, but her life and her experience and her importance, I think, even today.
Well, that's exactly what your novel does. I mean, I read your novel, but then it took me off in a half dozen different directions to pursue areas of interest that I frankly wasn't very familiar with. To read Love and Fury is to take really a step back in Victorian England and live the life of a Victorian, I guess. I'm so impressed with your ability to convey what I guess I would call, for lack of better terms, the mood, the landscape, the countryside. Even the home furnishings, when you're describing the inside of this house, I'm thinking, how does she know that? I know Samantha Silver. She never talked about that to me. The cultural artifacts of the era. Now, you had Dickens going for you because, in a sense, you were in roughly the same period writing Dickens. But I wonder if you could comment on the research required. And don't tell me you made it all up. One author told me that one time. I thought, you made it all up really well. I guess it's a novel, so you could do that. But I'm just so impressed with how you brought to life the period.
Well, thank you, Bob. I appreciate that. My first degree is in history from Boise State University. And so I love history and I love the research. And I'm a person as well who will go down a rabbit hole, you know, a tiny little rabbit hole, and spend an entire day there. So I mostly approach a book like this or a life like this as if I know nothing and I need to understand not only what was the milieu, what was, you know, what was the place, what was the, you know, the setting, the feeling, but what was her interior life and what was the, you know, the life of her family. And so I spent a lot of time. I mean, there's so many great biographies of Mary Wollstonecraft, you know, the sort of towering giants in the biography world, like Claire Tomlin, Janet Todd, Lyndall Gordon, Charlotte Gordon. And I read, you know, I read all of those, and there's lots of detail, and there's a book of her collected letters. So there's a great deal of information. And then, you know, you find the texture elsewhere. You find the texture and the layers by going down rabbit holes. And I found too that, you know, in reading the biographies, they have to stick to the truth. They have to stick to what they know. And so I was always looking for the tiny little gaps in what they didn't know and what they say they don't know that are really an opportunity for the novelist to mine as potential. For instance, Mary Wollstonecraft has this extraordinary, life-altering relationship with her first real love, Fanny Blood, who's a great friend, and I would say a soulmate. And Fanny Blood dies early. She's of tuberculosis. But there's a lot of conjecture about whether, in fact, it was a consummated relationship, whether it was a lesbian affair or only a friendship. And I spend a lot of time, trying to figure that out, trying to really understand not only what that relationship was, but what the constraints of the time were and how difficult it would be if they wanted to be lovers, even though they spoke, both of them, about wanting a life together, to build a life together without men, without marriage, without the tyranny of those things. They really wanted to figure out a way to be independent women and to live together. And so, it's a wonderful, so a biographer can't really go there because they just don't have enough evidence. But I, as a novelist, felt more freedom to really explore the intimacies of that relationship than are available to biographers and historians.
I'm Bob Custer here at Reader's Corner. Today I'm interviewing Samantha Silva, who's the author of Love and Fury, a novel of Mary Wollstonecraft. You also give the reader in the first few pages of the book quite the clinical take on the birth of Mary Shelley, the daughter. The details of that and how births happened then as opposed to how they're happening now were quite specific. And I just wonder if maybe you could comment. Is that reading a biography, or is there someplace else you go to the medical journals of the day to get that so exact?
There's a fantastic book that I stumbled upon called A Midwife's Tale. And it's an American midwife in the exact same period. And that was just, and it's her diary entries. And then someone, the author, commenting on her diary entries and sort of saying, here are the medical practices of the time. But there's so much richness in it. And there's, a lot of stuff online about midwifery in the period. And it was a period, which is interesting, when really women had been midwives and had really functioned as what we now consider obstetricians, but men decide, we're medically trained, we've seen a few autopsies of women's bodies, so we want to be there for the births. And and this is when you get forceps and all kinds of interventions that really increase both infant and maternal mortality for a long time. And sadly, Wollstonecraft ends up dying because a doctor, or her placenta doesn't deliver, and a doctor doesn't wash his hands and sticks them into her womb, and she dies of sepsis 5 days later. But I was very interested in creating the character of the midwife, because I think telling, the story of a whole life is really challenging. And for a long time, I had butcher paper up across my living room wall with, multicolored post-it notes, like saying that, here's an event, here's a plot turn, here's a plot twist, here are sort of the, the jewel-like experiences that form her and change her trajectory and propel her onward, to do the next thing and take on the next challenge. But it's still like how you string all that together with what kind of structure is I think very difficult. And then when I understood that she had died 10 days, she gives birth, she dies 10 days later, but that the first 5 days they thought the baby was too frail and would die, and there were rumors in the house that they were going to build a coffin for this baby. And then suddenly the baby sort of starts to nurse and gains strength and life force. And that's when Mary realizes that she's ill. And over the next 5 days, she's dying. And so I really wanted to focus on those 10 days, that very strange and sad intersection of the lives of Mary Wollstonecraft and her daughter, Mary Shelley. And the midwife was sort of a way to do that, so that each Each day is a chapter in the novel, and each of those days is introduced by the perspective of the midwife, who's sort of telling you what's happening in the room and in the household. But then Mary, the Mary chapters are her narrating the story of her life to give really as a, you know, as a legacy to her daughter. So I loved, like, once I had that structure, it was much more understandable sort of as a novel to me, and as a way to tell both her story and the story of the midwife, who herself is grieving a death and a life unlived. And so it was very helpful to sort of have that structure and the midwife. And it's easy to become obsessive about things you can learn about, you know, midwives and obstetricians of the period and this fight between men and women over who's going to control the birth process. So, of course, I was fascinated by all of that.
You know, Samantha, this is the second time someone's died on Reader's Corner through a book that I've covered. Candace Millard wrote a book called Destiny of the Republic, and President Garfield is featured in that book, dying from the very same thing you've described about Mary Wollstonecraft. That's a coincidence. It has no bearing on your novel. I just thought as I was reading your novel, oh, this isn't the first time I read about this. This is really bad news. Now there's plot, there's dialogue, there's prose. You've done each of those so well. What's the most challenging for you? What takes the most time? Obviously, you know the story, so it's a matter of filling in how this woman lived her life, and that involves the dialogue and the prose. First of all, did you start writing this after you wrote your last the Dickens novel, I assume?
Yes, I did. In fact, it was pointed out to me later that, you know, it sort of takes form as a mother-daughter story in a way, because I had just lost my own mother and was, you know, getting ready to send my youngest sort of off into the world. And there was this kind of liminal space between mother and daughter, and my own motherhood and my own daughterhood. And so, you know, that was rich terrain for me to explore. But I also think, as to your question, because I cut my teeth as a screenwriter, and really that was my first writing discipline, I'm a good scene writer. I think I'm also good with plot, but I'm a good scene writer, and I love dialogue. I love scene writing. So that probably comes more easily to me, but you still have to get those people to start talking to you, and you can find their voices in letters and biographies, but you sort of also have to find your own voice in their voice. And Mary Wollstonecraft is a very modern creature to me. I mean, she's almost a person who was born at the wrong time, you know, in the wrong century. Thank God she was, because she, you know, her arguments, we're still fighting over these things today. But that was, I think, harder to sort of, you know, do that, really become intimate. She's a huge challenge and a huge privilege and responsibility because she's so important as a figure. And there were times when I thought, oh, this is such a hard, sad story to tell, but a really important story to tell. And sort of finding, you know, becoming intimate with her and willing to really explore her interior life and sort of mine and hers was a rich experience, a rich and challenging experience. So the historical setting, like I thought I knew quite a bit about the French Revolution, but man, her experience, she travels to Paris after the, sort of immediately after the revolution and is there during the terror. And her experience in France is extraordinary. And, you know, I did a lot of reading. I mean, there you go. It's two chapters really about the French Revolution, but I spent months and months and months trying to understand not only what Paris was like after the revolution, but what her experience as an English woman and as a, you know, as a kind of intellectual activist was like in that world.
It has to be really tough knowing when to shut it down and start writing. And I mean, you could read forever on these subjects you've mentioned, but that there comes a point where, hey, I'm a writer, I better get this thing going.
Well, I think that I am certainly a person who always thinks, if I read one more article, if I just read one more book, then I'll be ready. And my father, who was a journalist in my growing up years, at one point said to me, you know, really, as reporters, what we had to do at some point is you stop looking at your notes. You just turn them over and you just write what you know. And I think that's a great instruction for writers of any kind, that you can't be regurgitating. You know, it has to go through the filter of you and through the lens of you. And so at some point you just, you know, you fill the well with as much as you can. And then you have to start, you know, doing the thing all writers dread, which is writing. And then, you know, as with Mr. Dickens, you get to a point sometimes where you feel like you're, you know, the vessel and it's flowing through you because you have sort of allowed, you know, created the interior space for yourself to have to be filled up with Mary Wollstonecraft and, you know, and be able to sort of spill it back onto the page.
You're listening to Samantha Silva. She's the author of Love and Fury, a novel of Mary Wollstonecraft. You mentioned her two failed relationships with these two gentlemen, and you have a quote that I think really sums up what she must have struggled with, and you've fictionalized it well. Had I become the woman I railed against? I wonder if you could share with our readers how that fits here in your novel. I mean, she resisted the idea and practice of marriage, and yet here she finds herself in these two relationships, and it was pretty tough going leaving those relationships.
Yes, it was. In fact, after when she left Gilbert Imlay, twice she tried to kill herself. So, well, she is born into a family where the father is really a drunk and a despot. And she decides very early on when she's a teenager that men are despots and that marriage is a tyranny for women and that there's really no way for that not to be true, that women give over their rights to men and husbands the same way that people do to kings. And so that's really, you know, a guiding principle through most of her life and why she has these, you know, these love affairs without desire really for marriage. And I think though that in her, you know, early years when she's writing about this, the tyranny and the oppression that's inherent in marriage, particularly marriage system where women can't divorce, where women don't have property rights, where women don't have rights over their children, that there's just, you know, there can never really be equality as long as the marriage system is set up that way. But when she's writing these things, she's also a virgin. And although, again, I do think she fell in love with her friend Fanny Blood, I don't know whether that's a consummated relationship. But as she, you know, when she begins quite late, really in her 30s, to have sexual experience and really have, you know, the overwhelming experience of falling in love with one, a married artist, and, you know, again, Gilbert Imlay, the American Gilbert Imlay, she's so overwhelmed by her feelings and honestly the experience of her own sexuality that it, you know, it leads her not to give up her beliefs because she still wants equality. And I think both Fuseli and Imlay are characters who also argue for, in, you know, in a way, equality between the sexes. I think Fuseli wants sexual equality and Imlay wants something else. But one of the things that really interests me about her is how complicated those feelings are and those choices are that she made, and to have a child out of wedlock and to have these sexual experiences without marriage. But it's really not unlike the complexities of women's lives today. You know, who do we love? How do we love? Do we give up our power? Do we give up our sexuality? Do we surrender our bodies, or can we continue to have power over our bodies? To what extent do we have rights? To what extent can we argue for our equality, equality of opportunity, equality of power, of everything, equality of love, of feeling? And so for me, she's quite a modern creature in this way. We're still talking about these things. We're still, you know, having these feelings and living these complex lives where we're torn between often our politics and what we sense as our responsibilities. and what's expected of us and trying so hard still to achieve the gender equality that she argues for 262 years ago. Her birthday was April 27th. So I think about that a lot. I can't believe even in the Idaho legislature, we're still having this argument about whether women should stay at home or not, you know, whether they're better off at home. This is a Wollstonecraft problem and she addresses it and we're still fighting over it today. So I see her, you know, I see her as in a way, you know, a precursor, two centuries old precursor to the Me Too movement. She is a woman who's trying to tell the story of women and her own life and how complex it is and how difficult it is and how much she has to overcome in a patriarchal world where men have all the power in order to have her own power. She famously says, you know, I do not wish women to have power over men, but power over themselves. And I just think she's so important today because it's exactly the same problem today.
So you touched on Edmund Burke, Samantha, and the way he reacted to the French Revolution and the way Mary Wollstonecraft came back at him. How does Thomas Paine find his way into her life?
Thomas Paine is English. And, you know, we think of him as an American hero, which he was, but he was English and he was part of the community of radical dissenters, later sort of Unitarians, who gather around Newington Green in London, in England, around this period, and you know they're all sort of these English intellectuals, who you know Mary Wollstonecraft has a seat at that table, which is amazing. But they're all talking; they're a buzz about the American Revolution, you know, and then the French Revolution, the possibilities of the French Revolution, and so. You know, Tom Paine is kind of a hero and he's a figure in all of them. I mean, he then moves to Paris and is a supporter of the French Revolution and eventually is arrested during the terror. So they knew each other. And I think it's interesting. I love the idea that Wollstonecraft, they were all very supportive of the French Revolution in the beginning, before the terror. For Wollstonecraft, she was not as much a supporter of the American Revolution because she thinks it didn't go far enough. She felt that it, you know, it codified the slave trade and codified slavery. And there was no possibility that the American project could realize its potential, you know, based on slavery, having codified slavery. She was very, you know, very much against the slave trade. And of course, England outlaws it much earlier than America does. But these are, you know, this is like it's such a heady moment because they're all, you know, revolution is in the air and it takes these forms, you know, in America it takes one form and in France it takes another. But I just, you know, one of my favorite scenes to write was when they come out of a dinner at publisher Joseph Johnson's house and they're sort of stumbling into the dawn after spending a long night talking. And there are people like on every corner reading newspapers about the French Revolution, like it's really happened. The storming of the Bastille, and what that must have been like for those people who talked about these ideas and these ideals all the time. This was the air they breathed, and then it was a real thing. It was really happening. So it's such an extraordinary moment, and she's so desperate to go to Paris and really be a witness, be a sort of journalist in the revolution, and she eventually does. She's one of the Tom Paine goes, and so does Mary Wollstonecraft.
Well, Samantha, you've done an excellent job of bringing your novel to life. And even though we had a half an hour to talk about it, it's not enough time. It never is. And that's the reason to buy the book. And it's called Love and Fury, a novel of Mary Wollstonecraft. Samantha Silva, thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks so much for having me, Bob.
Next week, Paris Review editor Emily Niemans talks with us about her fascinating novel, The Cactus League, just in time for baseball this season. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Custrow. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.